This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. The coast of North Carolina is biologically diverse with a variety of habitats: salt marsh, oyster reefs, sandy shorelines, and hard bottom habitats. These aquatic environments are important because they serve as a nursery for juvenile fish and crustaceans, support valuable commercial fisheries, and can even help improve water quality by filtering out pollutants. Researchers at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City are involved in a three-year study to learn more about an underwater habitat along our coast called seagrass beds. Often confused with seaweed, the fully submerged vegetation form dense meadows and salty and brackish estuarine waters. Associate Professor Dr. Joel Fodry says other than Florida, North Carolina has more seagrass than all other East Coast states combined.
In North Carolina, we sort of have every possible spatial orientation of grass bed that you can imagine. There are some places where there might be a single shoot of grass. And there are other places, like along the sound side of the Outer Banks, where the grass beds extend for miles and miles.
Here locally, in Bogue Sound and Back Sound, Dr. Fodry says the seagrass is patchier, made up of basketball to car-sized clumps of seagrass spread out across the bottom.
And what we're doing with our current experiments are really sort of focusing in on how those different orientations of the grass beds affect how fish and crabs and shrimp do use the grass beds.
Dr. Fodry received funding from the National Science Foundation, a $400,000 grant over the next 3 years to conduct the study. For months now, several technicians at IMS have been hand-making artificial seagrass mats to use in the experiment. It's a tedious process, taking about 2 hours to make just one mat, but it's the standardized tool in seagrass ecology that closely mimics the natural movement and habitat functions of seagrass.
To make these seagrass mats, we use a material called Vexar. It's essentially like a plastic netting, fairly rigid. And on that netting, we tie lots of green ribbon.
Curling ribbon, like you would use for wrapping a gift.
Each section of ribbon that gets tied on is essentially 6 inches long, which is about the length of our seagrass that we have here in North Carolina.
Dr. Fodry says each mat, about a meter squared, will be securely anchored with 16 long staples pushed down 10 inches into the sediment.
And once we put it out in the field, it'll be colonized by little tiny plants and animals called epiphytes that live on the blades of natural grass and will live on these artificial grass blades. And those little epiphytes are oftentimes things that are fed upon by the smaller shrimps or some very small fishes.
Around 400 mats have been made so far, thanks to a lot of volunteer hours, but they need a total of 1,800 before their experiment starts in the spring. Using these artificial seagrass mats in research projects isn't a new idea. Previous studies to observe crustacean and bivalve growth have been conducted on a small scale with mats 1 to 2 meters in size.
What's novel about this work, and probably why we receive funding, is that we're working at an order or two orders of magnitude bigger scales to understand how things like fishes and blue crabs and our panea shrimp, like white shrimp and pink shrimp and brown shrimp, much bigger animals respond to patchiness and fragmentation and patch size.
The current research follows up on a previous study where they explored fragmenting on natural seagrass habitats. In the wild, seagrass patches can be broken into pieces while others are contiguous. Dr. Fodry conducted fish surveys on each habitat type to determine whether or not fragmentation seemed to affect fish utilization.
And what we found is that there's an interaction between those two things, habitat amount and fragmentation. If you have a bunch of habitat and you fragment it, the fishes don't seem to respond. But then you cross some threshold, and if you have a small amount of habitat, if you fragment that any further, so you're not reducing the habitat amount, you're just changing the orientation of those patches, you do start to lose a lot of species.
That threshold is about a quarter of a football field in size. Dr. Fodry and several technicians will build seagrass meadows at that scale to explore fragmentation in greater detail. Using the artificial mats, researchers will have more control over unpredictable environmental factors. Certain variables like seagrass shoot density, patch size, and orientation can be altered to find out which habitats support the most biodiversity.
Now, they won't be like complete carpets of seagrass over a whole quarter football field, but 60% of that area will be covered by these mats, and that's at the big end. And at the small end, it might be something like only 5 meters by 5 meters. That might be the size of the grass patch that's at the smaller end of our landscapes that we'll be manipulating through this experiment.
Similar to the initial project's findings, Dr. Fodry hypothesizes that fragmentation on large portions of seagrass won't have a major effect on fish density. However, smaller patches with fragmentation will support fewer fish species and less fish than small contiguous patches. Their research and their findings are important for habitat and fish conservation and restoration.
Value of habitat, I think we all expect and appreciate and understand, but quantitatively, we're sort of behind. We try to explore in more depth how fishes and crabs and shrimps do use oyster reefs or seagrass meadows or other habitats so that we can try to put numbers to, if you lose X amount of habitat, you might lose X amount of fishery production. Or if you restore X amount or conserve X amount of habitat, you're gaining or conserving X amount of fishery production.
Over the next 2 years, they hope to make a total of 3,600 mats with the help of the community, school groups, and volunteers. If you're interested in helping with the construction of the artificial seagrass beds, call the Institute of Marine Sciences in Moorhead City. Their number is 252-726-6841. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. More than 1,400 projects are a part of the North Carolina Department of Transportation's 10-year State Transportation Improvement Plan. More than 250 of those projects directly impact communities in eastern North Carolina. Some projects are more controversial than others. Chris Thomas has this.
Last week, the State Department of Transportation released its latest strategy for improving the state roads, ports, airports, railways, and bicycle lanes, also known as the STIP. The primary theme in the East? Safety and connectivity.
Yes, compared to most of the state, this is a rural area other than the metro areas around Greenville and around Newbern, which is growing quite a bit.
John Rouse, Division 2 engineer, covering the heart of the region, including Pitt, Craven, Jones, and Lenoir counties. Divisions 1 through 4 cover the eastern third of the state.
Historically, we've had a high number of accidents, and we have had fatalities over the years on some of our rural two-lane primary roads. That is a problem statewide and, across the nation.
Winding two-lane country roads leave drivers vulnerable to car wrecks. In a 2008 report, there were more wrecks on rural roads than urban roads. That risk increases along with higher volumes of traffic, like on US 17 between Jacksonville and Newbern. That section of highway was originally completed in the late 1920s, nearly 15 years before Camp Lejeune was built. The first of four sections of the 22.1-mile project, widening the stretch between Jacksonville and Belgrade at the Jones-Onslow line, is completed. The additional three-quarters of the $145 million project, leading to the US 17 Newbern Bypass, is funded through 2018.
Over the years, with the development in Newbern, obviously, the development around the Jacksonville area, those areas have mushroomed, and the growth has grown quite a lot over the last decades. But, still had a rural primary two-lane highway that was trying to serve the connection between those two cities and those two metro areas.
In nearby Havelock, the North Carolina Department of Transportation has hit a snag with a long-standing project. The US 17 bypass has long been in the works, with plans initially made in the late 1970s. The proposed $220 million project is meant to alleviate traffic congestion and help accommodate a future interstate, I-42. But soon after a federal agency gave the project the green light late last year, the Southern Environmental Law Center filed a suit against the State Department of Transportation on behalf of the Sierra Club of North Carolina. The proposed route cuts through the Croatan National Forest. If the project goes as planned, acres of century-old longleaf pine trees will be cleared, along with living examples of the state's heritage, according to Southern Environmental Law Center representative Jeff Gisler.
We are the Tar Heel State because of the tar and the turpentine and the, what are called naval stores that were produced in the colonial days from the sap of longleaf pine. And so we have a long history with these forests.
The Croatan Forest serves as a habitat for the endangered red cockaded woodpecker. Gisler said the center has had its eye on the project, but ramped up its involvement in 2008 when the project's environmental impact assessment kicked off. About 2 weeks after the Federal Highway Administration approved its Record 4 decision in December 2016, the lawsuit was filed. Rouse said he couldn't comment on the legal proceedings, but in a December 29th report from the New Bern Sun-Journal, Havelock Commissioner Danny Walsh is quoted as saying, quote, "A lot of people have done a lot of work to ensure wildlife were all taken care of in the best way that they could be. This is progress," he's further quoted. "It's required for the future." Gisler believes the State Department of Transportation is passing up more useful and environmentally friendly options for the current plan for the bypass.
There is another alternative, which they rejected, that instead of going through parts of the national forest that have really great habitat, it would go through pine plantations. So trees that are already that are planted, that are not intended to be habitat, that are intended to be cut. So it would go through pine plantations and would leave the important habitat on the forest protected.
The project hasn't officially halted, but if the lawsuit is successful, it could severely hinder the project's progress, since it would vacate the Federal Highway Administration's record of decision and prevent the State Department of Transportation from obtaining additional necessary permits from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Further up the road in Greenville, construction on the 10th Street Connector is underway. The $69.8 million project links East Carolina University's main campus with the Brody School of Medicine. More than a mile of 10th Street, one of the city's main thoroughfares, closed last spring and isn't expected to reopen until 2019. That includes sections on and near Dickinson Avenue, an up-and-coming commercial area in the city. Near its intersection with Clark Street is CrossFit Greenville. One of its coaches is Adam Kolb.
We knew it was going to come. We have some clients that work with the city. We've got a couple city planners, actually, that are in that line, and so we knew it was coming.
Kolb believes construction will be good for the gym in the long term, since it will bring more traffic to the thoroughfare that connects downtown Greenville with US 258. But in the project's initial months, Kolb says some clients have had a hard time getting to the gym.
With the construction happening, it's been a little confusing for our clientele to actually get here, finding their way through these back roads. So they're just getting creative and finding different ways to get here. But when it's complete, I think it's going to be very, very good for the gym, yes.
Construction on the 1.4-mile connector is beginning to take shape along Dickinson Avenue. An approach resting on several pillars is visible amongst the relatively low-lying buildings nearby.
It's an urban widening project, as we refer to, so it's those projects tend to be complicated because you're building a multi-lane highway, you know, within a fully developed area. But so far, everything construction is going very well.
State agencies are gearing up for a new gubernatorial administration. That can mean major changes for the way things are done throughout the state. But Rouse doesn't believe the State Department of Transportation vote will shake too much.
In general, transportation is a nonpartisan issue. All parties, they want prosperity, you know, for the region. They want, quality of life improvements.
Other major projects in eastern North Carolina listed in the STIP include 5 ferry projects along the Currituck and Pamlico Sound, including $10 million for replacement ferries and new visitor centers in Swan Quarter and Currituck. Multiple bicycle and pedestrian route extensions in and around downtown Rocky Mount, totaling more than $6 million, and about $41.6 million for passenger rail services impacting northeastern counties near the I-95 corridor, including Edgecombe, Nash, and Bertie. I'm Chris Thomas.
Reading is relaxing. It reduces stress, it stimulates the mind, it also improves memory, increases knowledge, and expands your vocabulary. But for thousands of people in eastern North Carolina who have trouble reading or can't read at all, everyday tasks become difficult. That's why the Craven Literacy Council is offering a workshop to train volunteers to work with adults desiring to improve their literacy skills. The workshop begins next Tuesday and continues with sessions on January 19th, the 24th, 26th, and a final session on March 9th. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Community Outreach Director for Craven Literacy Council, April King, about the workshop and the state of overall literacy in Eastern North Carolina.
Now, April, what's the difference in literacy rates here in Eastern North Carolina compared to the rest of the state, most specifically more urban areas?
There's really very little difference. We work with adults, so we're talking about adult literacy rates, and in Craven County is 12% of the adults in Craven County read at a fifth grade level or below. North Carolina's average percentage is 14%. I'll give you an example. Mecklenburg's 11%, as is Wake. Pitt County's 14%. So they're all very close.
Here in Eastern North Carolina, have literacy rates improved, deteriorated, or stayed the same, in the last 30 years?
In the last 30 years, there is such a difference. Part of the issue is the fact that the definition of literacy now includes technology. And so when you are looking at, more than just reading and writing, it's also the listening, speaking, but also includes technology skills. So really, adults for that reason are falling further and further behind, and probably more are because of the technology aspect of it now.
And, of course, the rapidly aging of our overall population.
Exactly. We serve Craven, Jones, and Pamlico County. There are approximately 19,000 adults that have low literacy skills, very low literacy skills, just in our community. So the need is great. The problem is tremendous, and we have a waiting list and are unable to meet the need that's there, as well as the fact funding is not as available. It's harder to get today.
Overall, has the Craven Literacy Council's efforts to improve the rate of literacy locally succeeded, in your view, or is it, would you say it's still more of just an ongoing project that has to be looked at year to year?
It is an ongoing project. It's like in some ways we feel like we're treading water, because the more students we serve, the more tutors we get in, the more people we have coming through our door that won't help and that need help. And the folks that come into our door, they're motivated. They're coming to us because they want help. We're not going out chasing them. We don't even advertise for students, because we have so many students that are coming to us wanting help.
What has been Craven Literacy Council's biggest success, and on top of that, what is its most pressing challenge?
Our biggest success, I would say, is our ability to go with today's needs trends, such as technology. We're constantly improving our curriculum to meet the needs of the students. We also have, since New Bern is a refugee, has a large refugee population. In addition, we do citizenship teaching training as far as helping those apply for that. The pressing need, as is for most nonprofits, of course, is funding. So many people don't recognize that it's, it could be your neighbor, it could be the person that's right next to you. They are embarrassed, and they are not letting folks know that they need help. They're smart as they can be, because they have adapted, have coping skills, have compensated. They may go to a restaurant and say, I'll have what she's having, or I left my glasses at home. Could you read that to me? And no one would realize that they are having trouble reading.
Coming up on Tuesday, which is, I believe, the 17th, you've got a special workshop for tutors. What are the requirements of a potential tutor participating in the workshop?
The requirements for a tutor is the desire to help an adult with their literacy skills. If you have the desire and if you are patient, we will teach you everything else that you need to know. We are very much hands-on. The workshop is a 15-hour workshop, so you will learn all about the resources, about the materials, about how to communicate with students. All you need is the desire and patience.
What are the success rates of the students themselves in the program?
That varies depending on the student. It all depends on where they're starting from. So, you know, those that are starting at that first, second grade level, they have so much further to go. We have students that come in that may just want to improve their literacy skills or if they want to get their GED. So, you know, it's broken down into what their goals are.
April, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
Well, thank you so much for having me. We are just delighted to be here.
And if you need more information on this special workshop for tutors for the Craven Literacy Council, you can check out our events page at publicradioeast.org.
If any opera can warm up a cold winter's day, it's La Boheme. This Saturday, join me, Mary Jo Heath, for a live broadcast of this Puccini favorite from the Metropolitan Opera with a cast of rising stars. Soprano Eileen Perez and tenor Michael Fabiano are Mimi and Rodolfo, the seamstress and poet swept away in one of opera's great romances. Soprano Susanna Phillips and baritone Alessio Arduini are the combustible Musetta and Marcello. Carlo Rizzi conducts a cast that also features Alexei Lavrov, Christian Van Horn, and Paul Plischka. And during intermission, the opera quiz returns. Don't miss Puccini's La Boheme, Saturday on the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera International Radio Network.
The opera Saturday afternoon at 1 on PRE Public Radio East Classical.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Since there's not much to do outside right now, this is a great time to review last year's Garden Journal. And if you don't have one already, start a journal and develop a plan for this year. What is a garden journal? It's nothing more than a notebook or calendar that you use to record information about your garden each season. It can be used to record planting dates, the varieties that you grow, how varieties performed, when crops were harvested. You can track pest outbreaks, plan crop rotations, and more. I find that a three-ring binder with a couple of plastic page protectors or folder pockets works best for me. You'll want to make sure that you choose a waterproof pen or a pencil for note-taking. Otherwise, smudging is almost inevitable. What will you want to keep in your journal? First, it helps to draw a picture of your garden, including accurate measurements. This will help you determine a lot of things, including how much room you have to grow plants in, and thus, how much seed to buy. If you're like me, you'll probably get excited and buy too much seed anyway. But this will at least keep you realistic and in the right ballpark. The garden plan will also help you keep track of what you grew where in the garden. The biggest lie I tell myself is that I don't have to write this down. I'll remember what I grew where next year. The reality is that after a winter off, I often cannot remember what I grew where or what the particular disease pressures were in a given location. Having an accurate rendering of the garden plan each year helps me troubleshoot and plant proactively the next season. Tracking what crops you grow in each location will also allow you to plan your crop rotations. That is, ensuring that you don't plant closely related plants in the same area of the garden year after year. You will also want to use your garden journal to track orders, record planting dates, and note varieties. You can tape packing slips or empty seed packets right onto the page or tuck invoices into a page protector or folder pocket. Knowing what varieties, when, and how much you planted will come in handy later in the season. Likewise, if you learn about a new or interesting variety or plant, you can make a note of it in your journal and develop a wish list of things that you want to purchase for spring. One of the biggest benefits of the journal is keeping track of varieties that were planted from season to season. Each year, I like to plant different varieties, and sometimes I can't remember how one stacked up against another based on taste, texture, performance, or yield. Last year, I planted early Alaska snow peas as well as sugar snap. While both varieties grew and yielded well, the early Alaska pods were more fibrous, while the sugar snaps had a better texture. Because I noted this in my journal, I will certainly be able to take this information into consideration when I buy seed for this year. So if you already have a garden journal, review it and start making your wish list for this spring. If not, take a little time now to set up a garden journal. Your notes from this season will help you make better informed decisions in the garden next year.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.